Amen, Ken. Thank you. So here we are. We're at Exodus 9 through 11. It includes the final warning that Pharaoh's going to get. And this will involve three more plagues. We looked at six last week. And we find out in the final warning that the worst is yet to come. And if you go back to chapter 4, nothing that's going to happen to Pharaoh is really new to Moses. Now, Moses may not recall it, that God told him this. And that's not right. Chapter 3, 20 and 21. Chapter 3. And he says in 20, he says, I will stretch out my hand. This is God talking. I'm going to stretch out my hand. Of course, he's doing it through Moses. And strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. Now, we call these miracles the plagues, but they're miracles because they cannot be explained scientifically. And after that, he will let you go. And I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. But every man shall ask of her neighbor and a woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And you will put them on your sons and daughters, and thus you will plunder the Egyptians. Now, God had promised Moses this. And we sometimes forget, as we get into the midst of these chapters and get into the midst of these plagues, that this is the predetermined plan of God. And he told this to Moses before he ever left. He goes to Pharaoh and he says, the great quote, we say, let my people go. Chapter 9 and 10 we're going to look at today, it's about death and darkness. And what we're going to find out, that death and darkness bring more hardness. We find in chapter 11 that Moses is going to have the last word. And he tells Pharaoh in his final statement to him that your people will beg us to leave. In the process of this cycle of nine plagues, which are three sets of three, Pharaoh admits several times that he has sinned, that his decisions, which are sin, he says, my decisions are wrong, my decisions were sinful, and that's what's caused these bad circumstances. Now, this is a dangerous thing for him to say out loud. His sin has caused these circumstances. It's dangerous for his religion to say that. We're going to see that in a few moments. But he begs Moses to ask the Lord to stop the horrible plagues. He's simply trying to protect his country. And he's trying to protect it from foreign influence. And these Hebrews, the Egyptians have no love for these people. They use them as slaves to get their building projects done, but they don't like them. And he doesn't want them to have any influence. And he certainly, this is a rock and a hard place situation. He needs them to do the work, so he doesn't want them to leave. But they don't like them. They wish they weren't there. He goes to Moses and he says, you've got to ask your Lord to stop these plagues. And the Lord answers the prayer. If you read through this, you notice every time Moses went and interceded, God answered and stopped the plague. So the Pharaoh got his prayer answered. And the Pharaoh sees God answer Moses' prayer. But I've noticed as I read this, and I never noticed this before, Pharaoh never asks Moses that the Lord will change his heart. In fact, Pharaoh never goes to the Lord after he sees Moses goes to the Lord and pray, and Pharaoh never goes to the Lord and says, Lord, you must be out there. Will you hear me? Never does it. Only the Lord can change a heart. Only God can do what we cannot do for ourselves, and we cannot change our own hearts. Why? Because we're like Pharaoh. And what did Pharaoh do as soon as he got out of the circumstances he was in? He went right back to what he was doing. The miracles prove that Pharaoh does not want a changed heart. He only wants changed circumstances. The lesson for me here is, what do I pray for? What are many of the prayer requests that we see on prayer request lists for? God, change their circumstances. They don't deserve to suffer like that. Is it ever God, change their hearts, enlighten their minds? This is what Paul prayed. He always prayed, oh, may you be bold in presenting the gospel. May God enlighten your heart. May you be changed in your inner man. These are the things he prayed for. So hardening is an attitude that rejects God's plan and will. That's what Pharaoh's doing, right? 9:34. If you go to chapter 9, and we're going to take 9:34, 9:35, and 10:1, and this gives a perfect picture. 9:34 is a word that means to make heavy. In its root, it means to exalt or glorify. So it's generally used in terms of God. God is glory. God is kavod. That's the word used here. Pharaoh saw that the rain and hail and thunder had ceased, he sinned again and hardened his heart. Now that means that he exalted himself above God, which is rejecting God's plan and will. 35, to harden, that means to stand firm, to be stubborn, to resolve. It's a word that describes firmness or stubbornness. The word hardening is a little bit obscure because we think of rocks and hard things. In terms of a human attitude, we would say that person is stubborn. He's hard to discipline. It's called an intransitive verb, means it can't take an object. So when we translate it, Pharaoh hardened his heart, that's a bad translation because hardened there has an object, heart. It's Pharaoh is hard. Pharaoh is hard. And it's an active voice, meaning he does it. He is the one that I'm standing firm, I'm going to oppose God. 35, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. So that's almost like somebody's doing it to him. It's not. He's doing it. And he did not let the sons of Israel go. Now 10:1, this word for hardened changes, and it does take an object. It's now transitive, the way God uses it. This means to cause a hardening. I'm going to keep him stubborn. 10:1. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have what? I hardened the heart of Pharaoh. That's God acting on his heart. Pharaoh started a process, and God says, yeah, you want to go that way, so in your case, I'm going to let you go that way. In fact, I'm going to make it so you will become harder. I will cause you to be more stubborn. He's telling Moses, I'm going to keep him stubborn. He is not going to relent. He is not going to do what you ask him to do. Now we get into verse 2, and here are the reasons. 10:1-2. Why am I going to do this? So that I may perform these signs of mine among them. Among whom? Among the Egyptians. There's reason number 1. Number 2 is in verse 2. And so that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians and I performed my signs among them. You're going to tell your future generations. Moses, this is going to be a teaching object lesson for future generations. I want you to tell them what I did here, that I made a mockery of the Egyptians. Now, is that nice to mock people? What God is doing is he's making a mockery of their gods, the things they think are powerful, the things they think that bring them their power, their wealth, and their prestige. Why does he want Israel later in history to see that God made a mockery of their gods? What would that have a tendency to make people do? To not rely upon those same false gods. Oh, and Israel learned that lesson well, didn't they? They never went into idolatry, did they? Third thing, reason number 3, so that you may know that I'm the Lord. Moses, this isn't just for the Egyptians. This isn't for future generations. Moses, I want you to get this. Is it going to get easier for Moses? He doesn't know yet. He's going to wander for 40 years on the backside of the desert, the same place he had the sheep. But you know what the difference between tending sheep and tending people is? Tending sheep is fairly easy. Tending people is like herding cats. And here's the whole sweep of this section, 7 through 11, these four chapters. I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. He said what he was going to do. We looked at that last week, but they will see my wonders multiplied. That's what 7 through 11 is about. And these three purposes are all consistent with God's predetermined plan. So let's come to these last three plagues, 9:13 through 10:29. Hail, locusts, and darkness. And now for the first time in the plagues, we see human death. And this is the first time in these three plagues that we see the Egyptians believing that Moses has something over Pharaoh, and please, would you stop? Would you get him out of here? But in this plague, hail, this is a mockery of Nut, the sky goddess, the goddess who controls events from the air. And if Nut is doing her job, there shouldn't be hail like this. Or, what's the opposite? A very religious person would think, what have I done to offend Nut? So either Nut has lost her power or Nut is really angry. You got one option or the other. Neither one of them very comforting. Hail struck everything in the fields, both men and animals. It beat down everything growing in the field and stripped even every tree. Only place it did not hail was in the land of Goshen. But look at 9:15. If by now I had put forth my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, or what he just struck with disease, all the horses, the cows, the sheep, the goats, all kinds of livestock, he had just struck with disease. So now he's saying to Pharaoh and his people, if I had struck you with pestilence, you'd have been cut off from the earth. I could kill you just like that, but I'm not going to do it. But he's saying in 16, but here's why I don't. For this cause I have allowed you to remain, in order that I may show you my power, number one. And number two, more importantly, in order to proclaim my name through all the earth. God wants to be famous. God wants everybody to know who he is. And one of the ways he does it is to work miracles like this. But you know what? You know what's funny? Miracles don't always work. Why? Because men's hearts are hard. The hail has come. It's killed the livestock. It's killed people, slaves in the field. But you know, he warned them. Verse 19, if you look at that, therefore bring your livestock and whatever you have in the field to safety. Every man and beast who's found in the field, that means outside, not in a building, is not brought home. When hail comes, he will die. That animal or that man will die. Moses stretches out his hand, all this hail comes, it strikes in the field, it strikes man and beast, it strikes every plant of the field, as it says in verse 25. Everybody that's out there dies. But look at this. Verse 26, if you look at that, in the land of Goshen where the sons of Israel were, there was no hail. Nothing died there. God protected the land of Goshen and his people. So then look at 27. Pharaoh comes and says, look, I've sinned. The Lord is a righteous one. I and my people are the wicked ones. Very dangerous thing for him to say, by the way. Go ask the Lord, he says, make supplication, make this stop. God stops the hail. Verse 30, Moses tells him, I know that you want this stopped. I know you don't like this circumstance, but you're really not fearing the Lord. You're really not submitting. Verse 30, as for you and your servants, I know that you do not fear the Lord. And then Moses does a little parenthetical comment in here. He says, the flax and barley were ruined. The barley was in the ear and the flax was in the bud. That's all gone. That whole crop is gone, barley and flax. But you know why he tells them you still don't fear the Lord? Because you still got something to lose. You haven't lost everything yet. He says in verse 32, but the wheat and the spelt were not ruined, for they ripen late. So this tells us this is early in the harvest season. The next plague's going to come a little later in the harvest season, and it's going to ruin the wheat. But right now he's saying you haven't lost everything yet. 31, by the way, the flax, that ruins the priesthood because they can only wear this pure linen made from flax when they sacrifice and worship in their temples. What about the barley? The barley is how they made their beer. And they used their beer when the water at certain times of the year was a little too foul to drink. The next one is the locusts. Who is protecting the crops? But this is 10:3:20. And these locusts come, and it says, they will devour what little you have left after the hail, including every tree that is growing in your field. So this is where they lose the rest. And their locust god, there was a locust god who was kind of unnamed, and it was one of these insect gods. Now, there is a group of insects that they worship. This is where the officials say, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the people go. They're begging him now. Let the people go. Don't you realize that Egypt is ruined? Because now they've lost their wheat crop. And when you lose your wheat crop, what's that mean? No bread. It means we're going to be hungry. Hunger leads to famine. Famine is a disaster. Now think of this. What was it like when Joseph was in Egypt? There was famine in all the world. Anybody who wanted a grain had to come to Egypt. Now look what's happened. Moses is here now. Now there's famine in Egypt, and the rest of the world's fine. God blessed Egypt to get his people down there so he could keep them there for 430 years, and then now he's got to get them out, so he's going to turn the whole situation around. And he's doing this to keep his promise to Abraham, to get them out of Egypt. 10:21-29. Ra, the god of the sun, versus Yahweh, the God of light. There's a difference, isn't there? We were here for the beginning of Genesis. We found out that God said, and there was light. That's when the sun was created, right? No, God created the sun to rule the day. He didn't create a god to rule the sun. So this is the God of light versus the God of the sun. And the God of the sun is losing the battle because look at this. No one could see anything for 3 days. They couldn't see their hand in front of their face. The darkness could be felt. Look at this. All the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. So this is not affecting them. Again, this is God protecting the people of Israel. And here's Ra, if you've never seen this before. It's spelled R-E as well as R-A. But Ra, sun, the provider of all of life. Because they realized without the sun, they could not have life. Go back to our narrative, Joseph. When Joseph went to Egypt and he gets elevated up to second in command under Pharaoh, under the king, they called him the king. What did he do? Remember, he gave him a wife. The daughter of Potiphar Ra. The end of his name was Ra. He was a priest in the temple of An. And An was a temple that honored the sun god. So the capital of the solar religion was on the city of An. And this is the family that Joseph married into. This is Joseph marrying into this family. And the Greeks called this city of An Heliopolis. Polis, city. Helio, sun. Solar city. So Ra, or Re, is the sun. The sun god who's all life. Who's this next guy? This next guy is really interesting because if you notice carefully, he has the same colors, the same body structure, holding the same staff, holding the same amulet, except he's got a different head. This is Khepri. Khepri is the god of the sunrise, and he's the god of the afterlife. The sunrise is what comes after darkness. And so after darkness comes light or life. His name in Egyptian means to transform, transformations. So what happens to the sun between the time it sinks into the earth, and that's how they saw it, it sinks into the earth in the west. What happens to it between then and the time it emerges on the eastern horizon, where it's born again? That's what they called it. It was born again. And so the sun travels underground from east to west, and it undergoes this transformation because of the god Khepri, who then brings a new day, which is regeneration or rebirth. The heart of this is what was called the scarab beetle. And it was an amulet. And they would wear this over their chest, over their hearts. And when the sun rises from the ground or is reborn, it's raised by the scarab god who is associated with Khepri. And the scarab beetle was a beetle that rolled up its dung into a ball and pushed it uphill. So the scarab god was rolling the sun up like a dung ball in the morning, and it was transformed into light. And this is resurrection. So they had a doctrine of resurrection. And the scarab plays a role in the resurrection of the dead. And here's how the scarab does this. The scarab is an advocate to help the deceased person in his defense in the hall of the dead, or the hall of justice. And the heart was weighed in the hall of judgment. It was weighed against a feather. And if the heart was heavier than the feather, then the person was condemned and could not enter the afterlife. What role does a scarab play over the heart of the person who has died, who wants to be resurrected, who wants to be restored? It's placed on the heart of the dead person to prevent the confession of sin or fault. Because sin confessed out loud could then be used against you in the hall of justice. You see Pharaoh's dilemma? This is his religion. But this is where the scarab could help, because the scarab could perhaps cover those sins in the day of judgment. So the heart was hardened by the scarab and thus protected. So a hardened heart is a protected heart. The hardening prevented the confession of sin, which results in salvation. Hardening results in salvation. And this salvation means entrance into paradise, which they called the Western world. To the west of Egypt was paradise, the Sea of Reeds. The scarab can harden the heart. So you see what Yahweh's doing. There's a little sense of humor going on here, because God says, well, I'm going to honor your religion then, Pharaoh. I'll go ahead and I'll harden your heart, because that's what you want. That's what you think is going to save you. And here's the paradox. A hardened heart is a light heart. Here's the hall of judgment on a hieroglyphic on an Egyptian wall. I'm going to go through these because there's a process that's going on here. Anubis, this god here, he's the god of embalmment. So a person dies, they were very careful with the body. They would embalm the body. And this god of embalmment was leading the dead person to the scales of Mot. And Anubis would weigh the heart against a feather to see if it's worthy of joining the realm of the ancient gods. Paradise. The feather on the scales over here. The heart's over here. The feather on the scales right here. Here's the heart. The heart goes on the scale. You hope that the heart doesn't drop down. You want the heart to be lighter or equal to the feather. So then Amit looks like a little dog. He's watching that scale. That heart drops. He's going to devour the dead person. Devouring the heart of the dead person then is condemned. That means the end of his soul and the end of all existence. Now this guy in the end is Thoth. And Thoth is the god of wisdom, and he's marking everything down. He keeps track of everything this person has said and done. If that heart drops on the scale, then he's going to speak out loud the sins this person has committed. If the heart does not drop down, the dead person gets to speak. He doesn't know which way this is going to go. He cries out to his heart on the scale not to witness against him. Please don't say anything. And it's here that the scarab over the heart would harden the heart and not allow any admission of sin. O heart that was mine, permit me not to be wronged in presence of Osiris. Because Osiris is the king of the paradise. And if he passes the test, the dead person is now led by Horus into the presence of Osiris, the king of paradise. And having won the victory, Osiris welcomes him in and says, now let him dwell in eternal bliss in the field of reeds, the Western world. You can go to this website, and this website has the whole thing. It'll be on my website. If you want to go look this up, you can click on that. Go to this website, you can see the whole thing. So now we come to the final warning. You can see how he's in such a tenuous position in his religion. His officials are angry and upset with him. They want him to let this guy go. And here we have in the final warning in 11:4-8, this warning that follows a very heated exchange. And the heated exchange starts in 10:28. It's Moses and Pharaoh, they're confronting each other. This is right at the end of the plague of darkness. Then Pharaoh says, get away from me. Get away from me. Get out of my sight. They're very angry with each other. Beware. He's given Moses a warning. Do not see my face again. Don't come before me again. Because if you come before me again, I'm going to kill you. You're going to die. Well, Moses said, you're right. You speak well, Pharaoh, because I will never see your face again. This is the final warning. God has told Moses what he's going to do in 11:1-3. And when Moses responds, he tells him in 11:5, this is the warning, every firstborn son in Egypt will die. And then with that, Moses is done. When he says every firstborn son in Egypt will die, he's saying, my Lord, my God, he is the one who controls life, not Ra. Everything just went dark, Pharaoh. I defeated Ra. Now I'm going to do the next thing because Ra is the originator of life? No. You're going to find out because I'm going to take your firstborn child from you. And from every Egyptian in this nation, I'm going to take your firstborn child. God has already told Moses this already before this confrontation begins. So you got a narrative that's out of order. Because 11:1-3, the Lord had said to Moses, one more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go. When he lets you go, he will drive you from here. Speak now in the hearing of the people that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor the articles of silver and the articles of gold. Remember, he told him that's what's going to happen. You're going to take all the wealth out of Egypt. You're going to leave with all their wealth. And he's reiterating that again here. So now, verse 4 picks up the discussion that ended in 10:29. It didn't really end. It goes on now because here's where Moses gives him the warning. And Moses says, thus says the Lord, about midnight I'm going to come into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt are going to die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn of the slave girl who's behind the millstones. Everybody, nobody's exempt. All the firstborn of the cattle as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there have not been before, and such as shall never be again. This is going to be the day of days, historically. And now he's going to give the purpose. 7 and 8 are the reason he's going to do this. Against any of the sons of Israel, a dog shall not even bark, whether against man or beast, so that, here's the reason, you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. My people are separate from your people. And God's going to take this people and take them out, and his whole goal is to keep them separate from any culture that he puts them into. Now, what's the word distinct mean in its root? It's the Hebrew word kodesh. It's our word holy. I want you to be holy. Israel is holy from Egypt. To be holy is to be different, to be distinct, to not stand like those in your culture. And he says in verse 8, and all these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me and say, go out, get out, all the people who follow you, and after that I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. See, they're both angry. Pharaoh has threatened to kill him, and Moses says, you're not going to kill me. You're not going to see me again, but your son's going to die. And Moses leaves. And that's where we leave off. And we go here next week. We're going to do the Passover. Passover has implications for the present and the future for Israel. The section is chapter 12 through chapter 13, 16. This is the single most important event in history in terms of the nation of Israel. There was a whole segment of the law devoted to this particular day. This is a day of great judgment when many people would die, and great redemption when many people would be bought to be separate for the Lord. And that's what to be bought by the Lord means. You are now His. You are separated to Him. That means total separation. Pharaoh tried to compromise like three times. Say, yeah, well, no, you can sacrifice in the land. You can't go out of the land. Moses says, no, that's not going to work. We got to be completely separate from you. Okay, you can go, but don't take your kids. Just the men. No women, no children. Moses says, no, we all go together. We are all one. We are to stand separate, all of us, even our children, from this culture. We're to be totally out of here. 3 days. Out of the reach of the army. Then Pharaoh says, okay, you can go, but you can't take any animals. No, then there's no reason for us to go. Be separate for the Lord, but not your possessions. Pharaoh wants to compromise, and Moses won't do it. So it's judgment and redemption all in one night. You look at that. We'll come back next week, and I'm going to go through this pretty carefully because this is the foundation of the Old Testament salvation, is the Passover night.